Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Believe it or not, it's New York City and we're freezing, but the sun's shining, it's not raining, and that is so fantastic. I'm so excited. And I have the most wonderful author here of a book that is really ripped right out of the headlines, and I think everyone in the world should read it so that we would understand that we need to show more tolerance and understanding of other people. So on a rainy June morning, tens of thousands of people crowd into Duluth for the city's biggest annual event, the Duluth Marathon. There are a lot of runners, everybody is excited, and then all of a sudden a bomb goes off. And there's an explosion along the race course, leaving many people dead and injured. My favorite character, Jonathan Stride and Serena Dial, who nobody's allowed to kill off, and Maggie Bay, work with the FBI to find out who did this. Unfortunately, one man, Middle Eastern man, is in the wrong place at the wrong time. And watch what happens when you are wrongly accused because of what you are and who you are. So we have the author of Marathon, Brian Freeman, right here. How you doing?
I am doing great.
This is good. And I read all of your posts. And I posted your review with 27 stars the other day. And yeah, I did.
Thank you.
Yeah, I did. It's one of my picks for the month of May, and I'm going to post more of them later. And, oh, my God, if anybody else asks me to review something, I'm going to cry. This was a difficult story to tell because there are so many volatile issues that come to light. What is going on in the news? And the president, oh, my God, wants to ban many different races from entering our country. So how did this novel lend itself to what we're listening about, the travel bans and all of that, and current racial tension, I mean, in all the countries that are getting bombed by all these terrorist groups?
Yeah, you know, this book has been in the works for several years now. I think that anyone who sees the title Marathon and understands kind of the set piece behind it will know that it was all inspired by the events in Boston 4 years ago. And I can remember that during that, you know, April in 2013, Marcia and I were in Door County, Wisconsin, actually prepping for a library event. And we turned on the television and, you know, all of the news stations were broadcasting live from Boston and were taking us on this huge manhunt around the city. And, you know, I realized that the marathon is such an integral part of the identity of the city of Boston. And that is true in the city of Duluth as well. And so I made the decision right then and there that this was something that had to become a part of Jonathan Stride's world as well, and I've been planning the book ever since. But I decided very early on that I didn't want to write simply another book about terrorism. I think we've got a lot of thriller writers that you know approach that issue and you know do a fine job writing stories about that. I really wanted to go deeper and write a book that dealt with hatred in all of its rawest forms and particularly how hatred becomes a self-perpetuating cycle of violence and revenge and how social media is just, you know, creating this spiral of venom back and forth between people. And that's really the heart of Marathon. And that's where I was going with it. And so I knew from the get-go as I was writing it, that it was going to be, you know, timely in the wake of the things that were going on in the world. But I didn't, you know, I certainly didn't anticipate that it would prove to be, you know, even as timely as it is, because clearly, with all the political rancor that's been going on in the past, you know, several months, that it is truly ripped from the headlines right now. And ultimately, I mean, it's a hard book. It certainly does not give any quarter to any extremists on any side of the debate. But I hope ultimately it's also, you know, a healing book and deals with how we can start to bring people together, not just how people are torn apart.
That's so true. I think I started my review, which is in front of me. The First Amendment of the United States Constitution was created and written to protect the right to freedom of religion and freedom of expression from government interference. This book deals with freedom of expression and the right of freedom of speech, press, and assembly, and the petition on government to redress grievances and applied rights of association and belief to everyone. And so my next question is, why do people, I mean, after what happened in all these countries and ISIS and everything. Why do they assume that Muslims are terrorists automatically? I mean, they're here. They're not going anywhere. And just because they are doesn't mean that they're a terrorist. What did they stereotype people like that?
Well, you know, I think that you know, one of the major characters in the book is this young man named Khan Rashid, and you know, mm-hmm. Khan is a taxi driver in Duluth, and he's married and has a son, and you know, really all he wants to do is you know, live his life and practice his religion and be happy the way any one of us does. And he, you know, he knows that, being foreign, being Muslim, he occasionally gets the sideways glance from people. And his attitude is, you know, that's okay. People are wired to be a little afraid of things that are different. And he feels that way, you know, himself. I mean, everybody, I think, you know, sort of there's that instinctive human reaction that you're going to be afraid of something that's different from who you are and that exposes you to something that's outside your comfort zone. And the point is, how do we get past that, and B, why has it become so much worse in recent years? And I think that part of it is the way social media has changed how people react to one another, and it's kind of, you know, put us in our own silos with people who think the way we do, and it's created an environment where we're just kind of firing shots back and forth at people who think differently, and that's one of the reasons why in this book I have the incident at the marathon in Duluth taking place off stage. You don't actually see the bombing itself. Instead, the way you find out that something has happened, something has disrupted the marathon, is through tweets that start appearing in the book, and that's a very deliberate choice, because that's really how we find out about news these days. In so many cases, it's through Facebook, it's through Twitter, and that's, you know, there's a speed and an immediacy to that, which is great. But on the other hand, at the same time, you also get, you know, mistakes and rumors and misinformation and wild speculation that spreads virally with the same, you know, the same speed and power and reach of real information, and that's dangerous. I mean, it not only means that people can get the wrong idea about what's going on in a circumstance, but it also feeds that instinctive, you know, human prejudice and stereotyping.
That's true, because Twitter is very powerful. Facebook is to a point, but tweets can come out faster. So sometimes I really wonder if people are just trying to incite other people and just try to rile them up. And, yeah, it's scary.
And that character limit, I think that's part of it too. I mean, when you're reducing how people communicate to 140 characters, it strips away all of the nuance, and it just condenses it down into, you know, into sort of nothing but these spicy little fireballs. It kind of encourages people to just, you know, fire out these you know thoughtless, you know, emotional, you know, violent kind of tweets. It's like kind of, you know, a pipeline straight into people's ids. You know, I mean, they just shoot these things out, and it just does not promote, you know, the kind of thoughtful, reasoned dialogue that we really need.
That's so true. Unfortunately, I think your wife is writing a comment as we speak, because she sees me. I put it on Facebook that I keep the shows private because the shows are being taped for quality assurance and to make sure that there are no wrong comments, because I'm finding that myself and other hosts, I only had this happen once, have having people in the chat room that are kind of rude for no reason when they don't like the topic or anything like that. So I made the show public afterwards, and I put it on Facebook, and I said you can only ask questions related to the book or the plot, or if you have something nice to say. Otherwise, I'm not going to answer you. So
that's part of the problem. I just want to say that you know, I mean, it's as if, you know, I mean, and I, you know, it's striking that balance. I mean, I completely agree that, you know, in some ways we've gotten too politically correct, and we're reluctant to speak out. And anyone who says that people shouldn't speak out, you know, is crazy, and that is absolutely the wrong approach. On the other hand, acknowledging that we have the freedom to speak out doesn't mean that we should be, you know, thoughtless and mean in you know, the way we speak out in our comments. I mean, there comes a moral obligation along with the First Amendment that when you've got the the right to speak your mind, but, you know, you also have to, mm-hmm. you know, acknowledge that you're part of a community of people, and that means that you ought to treat people with respect.
Well, that's true. That's what I was taught growing up, and everybody, you know, treated everybody the same. And I grew up in the South Bronx, and there were a lot of different kinds of people there. And I taught in a difficult school in the Bronx, and I never, trust me, I didn't get this way for nothing, people. And I taught in a difficult school, inner city school in the Bronx, and I'm 5 feet tall and little,
and
nobody messed
like
with me. It was a very smart move.
Well, you know, it's like Twitter has become kind of the social media equivalent of road rage. You know, I mean, it's people that are speeding next to each other on the information superhighway, and they're tossing insults back and forth across the lane.
That's so true. And the sad part is that young people don't realize that Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, MySpace, and all of those, that's your resume. And they will look at it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yep, yep. No,
yeah,
that's
I know.
Right.
I mean, my nephew's graduating on Saturday. I'm so excited, from a university in Florida with a business degree. And he has learned not to do that. So,
right.
Jonathan Strite and his team are watching the marathon races, hopefully cross the line in the Duluth Marathon. But he feels like there's something, you know, you have a sixth sense that something's going to happen. So what makes him think has happened, and what is the controversy over the backpack that starts it all? That was a really good way to start it.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, clearly, you know, in the wake of Boston, I mean, that has totally changed the way the police, you know, deal with security at large scale events, and it has added a whole nother layer of anxiety for how you manage crowds. I mean, you know, these kind of big events are wonderful, you know, wonderful ways to bring people together. You know, but for someone like Jonathan Strite, there is always a level of anxiety because when you see that many people together, you're also perceiving the threats that go along with that, and so, you know, they have to be much more cognizant of you know, the potential of people trying to disrupt the events. They've got tactical teams that are, you know, on display. They've got, you know, bomb sniffing dogs going up and down near the finish line, and those are all the things that have to happen these days in terms of security at major events. So I wanted to echo some of Boston in what happens in the early chapters. But the first time that Stride has to deal with a backpack, it's actually a mistake. And what happens is that one of his colleagues, his young daughter, accidentally leaves her tiny little Barbie backpack sitting on the side of the road. And somebody calls it in, and, you know, it gets surrounded by the SWAT team, and then, you know, the little girl just wanders between them to pick up her backpack. And you know, it's a little humorous, and it kind of takes some of the edge off. But it's then, you know, for the reader, it adds this extra element of horror, because there's this clock going through. You know what time something's going to happen, and the clock is going through and ticking, and realizing that Stride thinks, oh well, I guess we've had our excitement for this year's marathon, and well, it's 3 minutes before the real incident is about to happen. And what's kind of funny is that event mm-hmm. with the Barbie backpack, that's actually based on a true incident that really did happen one time at the marathon in Duluth, where a child left behind this little Barbie backpack, and it got called into the police, and everyone was panicking for a little while until they realized that, you know, it was just a mistake.
Poor little kid must have been very upset.
Yeah.
Yeah, she must have been like, where's my backpack, my school bag? So my other character that likes Jonathan, but she has to give it a rest, too bad, is May, and she's handling one area and calls him to say she sees something. But why does she think it's made a mistake at that particular point? They're not really sure what happened, yet they think something happened.
And that's the thing. I mean, they have to be sensitive to everything. And so, you know, Maggie is she's kind of the one running up and down the marathon route in her dented Avalanche, because she's just an awful driver. And so, you know, I mean, Maggie and Stride get together and they think, you know, they think, well, this is just a mistake. And their colleague Max and Max's daughter, you know, they all feel bad about what's going on. And so, you know, they're kind of breathing a sigh of relief at that point that it's nothing serious. Unfortunately, the seriousness is about to overtake them. And again, I didn't want the actual events to take place, you know, on screen. I wanted to kind of keep that off and not showcase that moment of horror. Instead, I wanted to be able to pick up on the aftermath. I tiptoe you up to the moment of what's happening, and then I pick it up in the immediate aftermath.
Well, we have three major players that come into play. We can just say a little bit about them because we don't give too much away. We have Malik, Khan, and Hag. And what role did those three play together, or supposedly play together?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to have a variety of Muslim characters in this book, and Khan is really the lead character, and he is, as I mentioned before, I mean, he's just an ordinary man, and he's living his life, and in many ways his attitude is he kind of wants to keep his head low and stay out of the spotlight and simply, you know, live his life with his wife and child. And it's that very ordinariness about him that I wanted to capture and that I think makes him a very, you know, relatable character. I mean, he's not engaged in politics. He's not engaged in anything other than living his life. And yet he ends up getting pulled into this. You know, Malik, his friend, is, you know, Khan is afraid that Malik is being radicalized and that he's talking to the wrong people and that he's becoming so angry and so emotional and so caught up in the unrest that's going on in Duluth, and he's afraid that Malik is going down a bad path and he wants to try to stop his friend from going down that path. And then there's Haq al-Masri, and he's a professor at University of Minnesota Duluth at UMD, and Haq is sort of the local spokesperson on Islamic issues, and he's also a contact for Jonathan Stride, and he's one of those people that's trying to straddle the line and offer this balancing act that his first priority is his community and the people in his community. At the same time, he's also, you know, he's also cognizant that radicalization is a problem, and he knows that this is an issue, and he's trying to make sure that it stays out of his community. But everyone is concerned about Malik, and they're trying to make sure he's not crossing lines. And unfortunately, they make a bad call, which is rather than trusting Stride and getting Stride involved in the get-go, their concern is that as soon as the name goes to the authorities, it's the end of someone's life. And then they're not wrong to think that, but you make the best judgment you can, but sometimes you make a mistake, and that choice ultimately ripples through in some very unexpected ways. But you know, one of the most important parts of the book, I think, is the relationship between Stride and Haq, because both of them have the opportunity to kind of, you know, they're defending their own judgment and they're defending their own choices, and it kind of puts them at loggerheads sometimes. But ultimately, Stride has a line to Haq in the book that is for me really the line that defines the title of the book. And when Stride tells him, you know, that building trust between us isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. And I mean, ultimately, that's the message that it's going to take time to build trust, but that's the route that we have to go down.
Well, then we have the man that causes all the problem. When someone with a backpack shoves Michael Mayville at the marathon, he sets off a chain of destructive events because he sees Khan and he decides that he's the man. And at first he keeps fighting, and then all of a sudden he just gets him. Why did he do that?
Yeah, Michael Mayville, he's actually he's a character that my readers have met before. Michael Mayville is actually in my Stride short story, Spitting Devil. Michael and his wife, Allison, are at the heart of the Stride story, Spitting Devil. And I deliberately chose those characters, the Mayvilles, as characters to bring back for this particular situation in Marathon, because when you meet Michael Mayville in Spitting Devil, he's an angry guy. I mean, he's smart, he's entrepreneurial, he's very, very successful in launching his own business, and yet he's very quick to feel like the world is going after him. And in the wake of that story, and in the wake of some of the false suspicion that landed on his head, he sold his business, and now he's kind of at loose ends. And it means he's looking for a purpose in life. And one of the themes that comes up in this book, in several characters, is that the purposeless life is the most dangerous. It doesn't matter where you are in your economic circumstances. It doesn't matter where you are in religion or anything else. If you feel as if your life has no purpose, that is a risky business, because it means you're subject to doing the wrong thing in a lot of cases. And Michael Melville, I mean, he's a good man. He's a decent man, and yet, because he's kind of searching for this purpose, he makes a mistake. I mean, ultimately, this is a man. All that happened is somebody bumped into him and his son at the marathon, literally bumped into him. And there was this flash, this split second where they look at each other. And it's like having something that you weren't quick enough to capture in a camera, and it kind of goes in and out of your mind, and you think you remember it, but do you really? And after the incident, the marathon, I mean, Michael Melville becomes obsessed with the idea that he knows who did this, and that the person that he bumped into was the man behind this, because this man had a backpack. And so he does what a lot of people do these days, and we saw this after Boston, we see this after any kind of mass event. Suddenly you have ordinary people piling on to social media, looking at photographs because they're thinking, well, I can solve this crime. Michael Melville is exhausting himself going through all these online photographs of events from the marathon, because he wants to find this man that he thinks is the bomber. And ultimately, he identifies Khan, and that's how things begin to ripple out of control.
Yeah, they certainly do. So now let's get to my other favorite character. Serena's running the race, and he's waiting for her. He becomes concerned because he can't find her, and he can't find Kat. So why is he so worried about Serena, and how does Kat survive because she decided to do the wrong thing, which is probably a good thing in a sense?
Yeah, you know, I set up a really deliberate contrast in this book. That, I mean, obviously a lot of the issues are big, timely, dramatic issues. I mean, it's getting to the heart of a lot of things going on in the world, and there's a lot of violence, you know, that there's the risk and the potential and the fear that's going on throughout the city. At the same time, with all those big picture issues going on, I spend a lot of time with sort of a more intimate drama, and that is the relationship between Serena and Kat Mateo, this teenage girl that has appeared in the last couple of books, who's Stride and Serena sort of rescued from the streets, and who doesn't always do the right thing, and is kind of struggling with her past life and how does she get past that. And Serena has this frustration of how do I help this girl get past this part of her life, because Serena's been through some similar experiences herself. And so it's that drama, I think it contrasts these bigger issues, and that's where so much of the emotion and intimacy comes through in the book, is just these two characters trying to find a relationship. And so when Kat goes running down to meet Serena at the end of the marathon, because Serena ran the marathon, they're both at risk. And I love the little thing that happens is that, and it doesn't give anything away, that Kat once again made a bad choice. She saw a little beret in a shop that she wanted, and she had money, but rather than buying it, she went into the shop and she stole it. And by going in and doing that, by committing a crime, it meant she was about 30 seconds slower down the finish line than she otherwise would have been. And if she hadn't gone into that shop, she almost certainly would have been killed in the explosion. And so Kat is there struggling with the idea that because she did this wrong thing, and she knows it's wrong, because she did this wrong thing, that's what saved her life. And instead she walked out of the shop, and down the block, that's when the explosion hit. And so when Serena goes and ultimately finds Kat, and they have this very, tearful reunion when Serena finds out that the Kat is okay. But Kat is so struggling with the idea that once again she did the wrong thing, and for some reason doing the wrong thing is the reason that she's still alive, and she has a hard time understanding how that could be.
Well, she's a teen yet, and she finally comes to grips with the fact that maybe there is something with consequences when you make the wrong decision. In this case, the
right.
consequence was a good one. So this is a story with many issues that we hear on the news every day and in the newspapers and this morning on the news. Prejudice, racial hate, tension, fear of not being accepted, betrayal, disloyal, friendships and trust. Yet they all blend together with all the characters. How do these issues apply to Khan and Stride? And then we're going to get to the troublemaker for real.
Yeah, that is the challenge for someone like Stride is how do you understand, you know, what's a real threat and what's speculation? And when Michael Melville, you know, makes this sort of errant tweet that identifies someone, it's like setting a match to a fire, and suddenly everyone is convinced that this young man is guilty, and Stride is trying to decide. I mean, he can't be sure, and the hard part is in the aftermath of a major tragedy like this. I mean, there is now mm-hmm. such 24/7, you know, news and public pressure on the authorities that it's easy to go down a wrong path. And we've seen this time and time again. I mean, you look back at so many tragedies where the initial response was wrong, and they suspected someone that turned out not to be involved. I mean, I remember back when years ago when there was the bombing at the Olympic Park in Atlanta, and
mm-hmm.
And suddenly this security guard, I think his name was Richard Jewell, was falsely, you know, accused and sort of became the centerpiece of the manhunt, and he was completely innocent. If you lift up a circumstance like that and put it down in the current climate where now you've got not only the 24/7 news cycle to drive this story, but you also have the power of social media and Facebook and Twitter to spread misinformation with this astonishing viral speed, it means that you always run the risk that that someone is going to have their life completely turned upside down by these accusations.
Mm.
And you've got someone like Stride who's you know, kind of the guy in the highway with his hand up as the truck is coming forward, saying, you know, hey, I'm trying to stop this runaway truck here before before something really bad happens, because you know what, guys, we don't know what the truth is here, and let's stop,
mm-hmm.
let's slow down. I realize everyone wants to know what happened, they want the facts, they want the truth, but you know what, truth takes time to emerge, and it's awfully easy in those first hours after a major event to have, you know, speculation and rumor and error running wild, and the key is that, you know what, until you really know, you have to force yourself to slow down. Even though everybody is used to this immediate gratification these days, they want information fast, they want information now.
Sometimes I wonder if people hear the truth but want to hear their own truth and don't really want to hear what's really
sure
out there.
Yeah, well, I think these days, you know, again, it's another thing about social media. It allows you to be pretty selective
mm-hmm.
in the information that you hear, and everyone on all sides is guilty of doing this. I mean, you know, this doesn't belong to the left or the right. It's just human nature that we tend to look for information that kind of reinforces our previous belief and tells us, hey, yeah, we were right all along. And it's harder, it's more uncomfortable to be listening to people that have very, very different opinions than we do and that challenge what we are thinking. But, you know, I mean, that's the point of society is if we had all the answers, we wouldn't need these debates. But the fact is, no one has a monopoly on the right way to go forward. We have to have that uncomfortable melting pot of ideas in which we you know, debate and discuss and try to, you know, come up with a way forward.
Well, tell us about Dawn Bash, and what was her real purpose?
Dawn Bash, yes, Dawn Bash. she styles herself a First Amendment activist. And so she goes around the country doing these symposiums in which she essentially, the goal is to kind of pretty much just, poke a finger in the eye of Islamic extremism and say, look, if you say we can't, do cartoons of Muhammad, then, well, that's exactly what we're going to do. And she puts it in the context of, well, this is about, defending the First Amendment. And even Stride says, look, her underlying idea isn't wrong. I mean, the idea should be that everyone should be able to tolerate and deal with, people that say and do stupid things, and that the response to people that are rude and insulting and mean-spirited is not violence. It ought to be really, either ignoring them or laughing at them or recognizing that mm-hmm. they don't, their opinion doesn't really count. But violence isn't the response. Unfortunately, she's someone that takes that kernel of truth and takes it too far, and she's one that is as extreme and intolerant on her side as the extremists on the other side are as well, and she's almost sort of hoping for violence because violence is mm-hmm. what gives her gives her headlines and has people buying T-shirts and buttons and hats and things. So she's one of those folks that is sort of cynically exploiting all of the conflict in the world because it gives her a platform, and she's now in the book been doing this in Duluth, and it's been creating this unrest and these protests and this division in the city for weeks, and that's why in the beginning of the book Stride is so on edge about the marathon mm-hmm. this year, because it's taking place in the context of all this political rancor that Bash has been promoting for weeks in the city.
And she's using the safeguard as the First Amendment so they can't stop her, supposedly. But isn't
right,
there something
right.
in the First Amendment that says, because I read it like seven times already, that says that you're not supposed to, if it's going to hurt the national security of the government, you're not supposed to say it. I mean, I did, my nephew called me at 2 o'clock in the morning on Monday to help him with an assignment on the First Amendment, exactly. I read 20 articles in an hour and had to help him type up notes in the middle of the night. And I must have read everything on the First Amendment in colleges and stuff. And there are certain parameters that they're trying to set for what you can say and what you can't say. And she seemed to just go off on anything she wanted to say. So why couldn't they stop her to a point to say, more people are going to get hurt. This is wrong.
Well, and see, that's the problem is that you look in what's going on today, and you have a lot of speech being shut down at colleges, and you have someone mm-hmm. like Howard Dean standing up and say, well, hate speech isn't protected by the First Amendment. Well, sorry, Howard, but of course it is. I mean, the whole point is that. The First Amendment is not designed to protect easy speech that we agree with, because that there's no mm-hmm. challenge in that. I mean, the point is that the First Amendment protects speech that makes us angry, that makes us deeply uncomfortable, that violates what we believe is, mm-hmm. is right and normal. And the point is that the response is not to try to ban that speech, and the response is not to try to say that people can't say things. The response is to put it in context and to realize that frankly, if someone is speaking in extreme language, the worst thing you do is give them a platform. I mean, the point is that so mm-hmm. often these days we end up highlighting people that say these stupid things and giving them more power and credibility than they otherwise would have by trying to shut them down and by trying to challenge them. And I would say, look, the best thing you can do if someone is speaking on your campus, don't elevate their, if they have views you disagree with, don't elevate their views by trying to shut them down and say that, those views have no place in society. Don't show up, or show up and laugh at them when they say things that are crazy, because it's those responses that actually, put hateful speech in the correct box. But trying to stop speech is the wrong approach. I mean, the point is, you shouldn't respond violently to speech. The point is that you should be able to recognize that you know, speech may make us uncomfortable, but ultimately, you know, it is the cornerstone of you know, what makes this country great. And yeah, there are people that are going to push the envelope on that, and the point is not to, you know, to not try to shut it down, but to not give it more power than it otherwise should have. And that's true with you know, Dawn Bash as well. And that's the line that Stride tries to walk, is to say, look, I can't shut this person down, but I also want to try to appeal to, you know, to everyone's better angels, to be able to have them to not do something simply because the First Amendment says that you can.
This is so sad, because what happens with Khan? This is about forgiveness for not only those who did the wrong thing, but those who were wrong. So how does he react when he's accused? And what happens to his wife and his family? That's even sadder.
I think it gives away too much to talk about the details of what's really going on. But, you know, suffice it to say that his world is completely turned upside down, and he gets pulled into things that he otherwise would never get pulled into because of, you know, this one mistake by Michael Melville, and that is the point, is that it is so easy for, you know, one simple mistake amplified in this gigantic echo chamber of social media to have real life effects on real people, and that's something that it's awfully easy to forget when we're sitting there with a smartphone in our hands or sitting at a keyboard, that, you know, mm-hmm. what pushing tweet in some of these circumstances, it's not simply, you know, sending words out, it can translate into real world actions. And there are people out there who will take one kernel of information and react badly and wrongly and do the wrong thing. And it's not to say we shouldn't speak out, but at the same time, we have an obligation to be, you know, thoughtful and reasoned in what we do, and to not get in the midst of things that we have, you know, no business getting in the midst of. And unfortunately, that's what Michael Melville does, and the results really begin to upend Khan's life.
That is sad, because some people just do it for the attention, and a lot of times they don't sit and say, well, what are the consequences of my actions? And sometimes they just don't care, which is really sad.
Yeah, well, and again, it's this idea that the purposeless life is most at risk. I mean, and some of these things, I mean, it gives people a purpose, but unfortunately that purpose, you know, maybe, you know, morally corrupt, and again, that's true whether it feeds extreme views on all sides of the political spectrum.
That's so true. So tell us about Wade, not a little bit about Wade, and how he comes into play in this particular novel, because a lot of complications here.
Yeah. Well, Wade is a runner. He's running the marathon, and he's getting toward the finish line, and there's his wife and the two of the coworkers in his business, you know, standing there cheering him on at the finish line, and then, you know, the next time he's conscious, he's staring up at the sky, and you know, the rain is coming down, and something has happened. And so, you know, when we see him again, you know, he's in the hospital and bad things have happened to the people in his life, and his colleague and sort of friend Travis is with him in the hospital and telling him about the horror that has happened in the wake of the incident at the marathon. What we see is how that cycle of violence and revenge begins, because someone like Travis, who is sort of miraculously uninjured simply because of where he was standing, in talking with Wade and looking at what has happened to his friends and family, is you know, becomes consumed with the rage and anger of you know, what has happened. And you know, when people become enraged and they combine that with horror and grief, in a lot of cases, they want to do something. They're not thinking about, you know, what's right and what's wrong. They just want to do something.
Let's talk about the investigation a little bit, because I've got a few more questions. And before I forget, everybody, tomorrow at 10, I am interviewing the head writer of Murder, She Wrote, Tom Sawyer, will be here. For real. On the 11th, Kurt Cam, Code Blood. On the 15th, the author of I Love You Today. And on the 17th, we're going to talk about another issue in the news, gang warfare and gangs that are turning up in Suffolk County, and where people have to do, mayors have to perform create a task force. And three authors will be here for that: Christina Hogue, Bernard Masters, and Bruce Coffin, who will deal with that in their everyday life. And on the 22nd, the author of Crossing the Street. And on the 24th, one of my favorite people in the whole world, Alan Topol, the Washington Power Play. And to end May, Big City Heat by David Burnsworth. And that's just some of what I'm up to for the next 2 weeks. So why does Serena bring Kat into the investigation? And how does this help her to foster her trust in Kat even more? And she's 17. She lives on the streets. And she requires that she contacts Kurt, who's not the nicest person in the world, but concedes, you know, consents to help him. Yeah, the character came for the other book, the other last one, Jonathan Stride. So why did we bring him back in? I don't like him.
You know, he's fun. You know, I mean,
he's
always kind of Kurt is always kind of treading the line of he's kind of a you know, a sleazy little con artist, but there's a certain charm about him as well. He's so irrepressible in his willingness to kind of skirt the edge of what's legal and what's not, that I do have a little bit of a softness in my heart for Kurt. I think one of the interesting tensions that comes out in something like this, and certainly there in the book, is this idea that when you have a major incident that takes place, sort of inevitably what happens is the politicians bring in the FBI, and the investigation becomes sort of more nationalized. That's inevitable because the federal authorities are able to bring in a depth of investigative resources that most local authorities do not have. And yet at the same time, what the local authorities have that in most cases the federal authorities don't is that knowledge of the local community and the contacts in the community and the ability to really understand how a crime fits into what's really going on in the life of that particular city. And so I think that's what you find here, is that there's sort of hints of an underlying incident that makes Serena wonder, well, what's really going on here? And she sees a little coincidence involving the area where the bomb took place, and it seems like it ought to be nothing. And yet, you know, Serena's the kind of investigator that if there's a loose thread, she wants to pull at it to see, you know, what happens. And so she starts looking into this, and the one person that is likely to sort of be able to help her in this is Kat, simply because Kat came to them from a life on the streets and sort of knows the homeless community in Duluth and has a lot of contacts with folks that can sort of lead Serena into this underlying world to try to find out what this original incident was all about. And that's how Kat then takes her to see Kurt, and Kurt, you know, again is kind of this a sleazy but charming con artist, and there he is, you know, selling, you know, homemade craft beer down by the lake because so many of the stores in town are closed in the wake of the bombing. So that again it brings Serena and Kat into the investigation. It brings Kat into the investigation, but at the heart of it, what it's really about is Serena and Kat kind of developing a stronger relationship. And Serena has always felt a little bit like an older sister to Kat because of, again, the idea that she went through some similar things in her childhood. And yet you can see in this book that that relationship is evolving in a different direction. And Serena realizes that she's really sort of more of a surrogate mother to Kat, and that she's very touched by realizing that that's the way Kat sees her as well. And for Serena, someone who can't have children, it's it's an awakening moment for her to realize that this teenage girl is really looking to her for, you know, advice and guidance and help figuring out her life. And so I think it makes for some very touching scenes as the two of them sort of kind of start finding their way together.
I know. That's why you can't get rid of even one of them. Sorry.
I've always promised readers, you know, I won't kill off a major series character because I really feel that I understand why writers do it. I understand you can sort of inject this jolt of energy into the series, but I always think it's unfair to readers because it kind of cheats them of the ability to rediscover the series and reread the series because they can never enjoy the earlier books now because they're always shadowed by what happens to this character down the road. So I really like to stay away from that.
Well, this is good. So we have Hag and we have Stride. And they're not friends. Their relationship deteriorates when Stride suspects Khan of the bombing from all of the things that are happening. And, of course, Dorne, you know, incites everything, so that makes it even worse. So how does he deal with that, Stride?
Yeah, Stride is kind of he's kind of the guy trying to hold all these threads together because he's in the midst of everything. He's got the FBI, pushing in one direction and he's dealing in particular with one FBI agent that has has a violent tragedy in her past that may be kind of blinding her perspective a little bit. And so that's pulling him in one direction. He's got his relationship with Hawk and the Muslim community pulling him in another direction. He's got all these suspicions flying around on social media. He's got Dawn Bash, who is sort of continuing to sort of throw gasoline on the fire. And so, there in the midst of this is Stride, and he's got all these threads pulling him in different directions. And at the core, his priority is two things. He wants to find out the truth about what really happened at the marathon. And he wants to make sure that all of this, all of this anger and speculation does not spill over into more violence in the city. And so he's trying to hold the community together. And so in some ways, I mean, I've said to people that Stride is more of a supporting character in this book than in some of the other novels. And yet his role is absolutely vital because he's kind of the one that's trying to keep everyone together and to avoid having everything just spill over into this cyclone of more violence.
We have one more character, Gail Durkin. She's interesting, and she feels guilty because she feels that she is responsible for the death of someone. And how do you deal with that? Because she's an officer, she can't believe that happened. That's hard. I must say, the first time you actually kill somebody.
Yeah, Gail Durkin is a young FBI agent. She lost her brother in a terrorist incident overseas, and that has kind of shaped who she is. So in her past, she'd made a mistake. She'd crossed a line that she couldn't cross in dealing with a witness, and wound up sort of on suspension for a year. And now she has an opportunity to get back in the game, but she is sort of haunted by what happened to her brother and is trying to separate out her personal emotions from doing the job and telling Stride, well, look, as long as I can do the job, what I really think doesn't matter. And Stride's reaction is, well, if you're able to do that, good for you, but that's just not the way it works. And if you think you can simply put your emotions aside, you can't. What you need to do is deal with them and be able to decide if you can really get past them. And then that's the ultimate conflict, I think, that Gail faces in this book is can she get past, the anger and the grief that she felt, and can she really do the right thing in her job? And along the way she makes mistakes, and that I think is that's sort of an underlying theme in the book that kind of comes up again and again, is this idea that, people make mistakes, and the idea is how do you live with that? Because you're not going to not make mistakes. You're not going to have situations where you don't where you always do the right thing. I mean, Michael Malville makes a mistake. Gail Durkin makes a mistake. Khan makes a mistake. Hawk makes a mistake. Everybody in the book, I think, you know, Cat makes a mistake when she goes to steal that beret that ultimately saves her life. Everybody's making mistakes. And the point is not to think that you're ever going to get past the idea. You're never going to be perfect. But how do you sort of deal with the mistakes that you make as a human being? And how do you, you know, move forward with your life and get past the things that you've done? Because it's not the idea of making mistakes that define you as a person. It's how do those mistakes change you and make you a better person?
Well, the first step is to admit that you made a mistake, and it's hard to forgive yourself in all these cases. Sometimes it takes time. But the first thing you have to do is admit that you made a mistake and not hide the fact that you made it. And a lot of people won't own up to it. So why does Dry say, this comment was fantastic, why does he say he was smarter when he was younger? I couldn't resist. Sorry, that was so hilarious. And I, you know, it's funny because I said to my husband the other day, I'm smarter now. I'm smart when I was younger, really smart, an A student, but I'm sharper now. So, haha,
yes,
people.
Yes,
he works in both directions.
Yeah.
Why does he say he was smarter?
I love that. I love that comment from Stride. You know, he's talking to Gail Durkin, and Gail is young and pretty sure of herself. Mm-hmm. And you know, Stride's attitude is, I get it. You know, I knew everything when I was young too. And it's hard as you get older to realize, you know, how little you really know. And you feel much smarter younger because you just have less life experience to recognize there are an awful lot of shades of gray and there are an awful lot of nuances in every situation. It's easy to think that everything is black and white. And unfortunately, the older you get, the more you realize you don't know. And that's a humbling, it's a humbling experience. And I love that has become a Stride's awareness. And this is a book where Stride is kind of becoming aware of his own age and maturity. I mean, he just turned 50. And so he's recognizing that he's not the young cop anymore. But, you know, at the same time, there are advantages that go along with age and maturity that he's beginning to appreciate.
I can understand that, but I haven't grown up yet, so I don't care. I'm always going to be 12 or 21, whatever. So he's only 50, which is not old, people. It's not young, but
there we
go. What can I tell you?
What scares me is that when I started writing these books 12 years ago, I was younger than Stride, and now here I am. I'm older than Stride. He's got it figured out.
I'm not going to even touch that one because I don't want anybody to figure out how old I am. Somebody actually asked me that in the bakery the other day. And I came up with my classic answer. She said, "How old are you?" I said, "Older than some and younger than most." That was my answer.
There you go.
Yeah. So he's only 50. He's vital. He's agile. He's really hot, too. Are you going to ever promote him?
I think Stride's the lieutenant. He's the head of the major crimes area. The last thing Stride would ever want is to be the deputy chief or the chief of police. I think he has so little patience for the politics that he likes where he is out on the street.
Okay, now I have two more questions. This is a long one, I think. Knowing the current volatile climate, and I listen to the news every morning, and I listen to BBC and all of that, about a judge upholding the travel ban because there are 6 countries where terrorist cells have been born, and who knows how many of these people are here, it's too late, or good work or not. How should people think about Muslims, Syrians, people from Saudi Arabia, and other countries that are not exactly fond of Americans, and why are they always targeting Britain and France? Now that France has a new president, maybe that'll be a positive sign when Macron won. And what is their primary objective? How do you change the mindset of people?
Wow, you're asking for a lot with that question, Fran.
What can I say?
solve the problems of the world in 30 seconds or less. Ultimately, I mean, these are tough, complex, intractable problems that have roots going literally going back centuries, and you know as Stride says, we're not going to solve these things overnight. It is a marathon trying to build trust, and ultimately, if there is one message in this book, and one way to maybe begin that process is that boy, we really need to start talking to each other, and we really need to start mm-hmm. listening to each other and not assuming we know what's going on in other people's lives and opening up, you know, our heads and our hearts to how other people see the world. We can get so far, I think, it's simply we just simply talk more to one another and to people that are different from us and have different experiences and listen to their, you know, the things that have shaped them. I think it's those simple interactions that begin to make a difference in the world. I mean, if there's one thing that I have found disappointing, I remember years and years ago, probably 15 years ago, I did what was called a Leadership Minnesota program where I went around with a group of folks in the state and met with a lot of legislators and business owners and things around Minnesota. And I was so discouraged to find out that the Republicans and Democrats in the legislature spent almost no time talking to one another. I mean, literally no social time, no, you know, time for them to get to know each other as people, to get to know their families. It was enormously discouraging because that is what creates the polarization and it erodes the ability to do anything on a bipartisan basis. It's people aren't talking to each other, and that is mm-hmm. where I think we need to start making a change, is to just get people realizing that, you know what, just because somebody thinks differently about the world than you do does not mean that, you know, that they are the enemy. It just means that you need to find out what their perspective is, because everybody has a perspective, and we can all learn simply by spending more time listening.
You're right. They have to hear the words and understand what they're saying and not assume that they're trying to be harmful. And finally, what would you say to Fried about handling the next marathon? I mean, they try so hard with security, no matter what you do, sometimes it's not going to matter. What would you say to Stride about handling the next one, if there is one? And what would anyone say to Khan about dealing with the future?
You know, I would say, you know, on the marathons, I mean, because I've seen it. I mean, I've been up at the marathon in Duluth the last couple times, and I've spent a lot of time talking to the folks there about security. You know what? You've got a lot of wonderful, talented, committed people, you know, that work for the marathons around the country, mm-hmm. that work for the police around the country, that mm-hmm. their priority and their mission in life is to keep people safe. And, you know, so I would say, go run, go cheer, and you know, don't worry about, you know, don't worry about the rest of life. Just be you know, just be cognizant, aware, and realize you got a lot of people that are working hard to make sure that everything is safe and safe and fun and uplifting, which is what marathons should be. I mean, it is one of the great experiences, I think, of athletes. I mean, it's so wonderful to see the kind of support that they get. I mean, the commitment that the athletes have and the kind of great support they get from the people that line the roads. I mean, that's just a tremendous, tremendous experience.
I did it only once. It wasn't a marathon. When my sister was alive, she got me to walk for the March of Dimes for 6 miles. And I think it was just different back then because there were, you know, people at each spot, but there wasn't that much security. And I never walked 6 miles before. That was an experience, and everybody should try it. Even if you work, yeah, you should try it, seriously. And
yeah,
I'm like, oh, my God, I'm going to.
Walking 6 miles, that sounds about my speed. Running 26 miles, that not so much.
My nephew did. My nephew did the triathlon last two weeks ago in Arizona, and he did a 30-mile bike ride.
Wow,
and then he did a 30 lap something or other. He said the only thing that got him was when he was running coming back, his leg bothered him, but he ran it through and he finished it. He's amazing. So
that's
yeah,
great.
You could do it. But then again, he's only 20. He's going to turn 20. Can't believe he's that old.
He's a kid. Yeah.
You know, so what's next for my favorite Stride and Serena and Kat? And
yeah,
I like the ending of the story. I like what happened with Kat at the end of the story. That was really good.
Good. Yeah, I've got a lot coming up. The second book in my new Frost Easton series set in San Francisco, that is done. That will be out next January. It's called The Voice Inside. Very, very chilling follow-up to my thriller, The Night Bird. And then I will be
working
on the next – But yeah, it's so fun. It's so creepy. It's gotten a wonderful response from readers. So The Voice Inside is the follow-up to The Nightbird out in January. And then this summer, I dive back into to Mr. Stride and Duluth, and I'll have another Stride novel out probably around the same time next year.
Oh, that is fantastic. Well, I'm going to tell everybody, I have to, once in a while, I have to blow my own horn, I hope. I'm hoping that I get my contract soon. I got picked up by an independent publisher. And
fantastic.
Titled. Yeah, I'm getting people to read it, too. I'm hooking anyone that wants to be brave enough to read it. It's called The Daughter's Promise. When my mom was diagnosed in 2003 with Alzheimer's, she made me sit down and write a note to her that said that I would never put her in a nursing home or in a facility, and that I would manage to figure out a way, and let me tell you, it was hard, to take care of her at home with the proper care. And
sure.
$6,000 a month and working my tail off to get her full Medicaid, and I finally did, on a strange incident that happened, it's in the book. I promised myself I would write it. I wrote The Vanishing Mind of Bruce Orloff, but this is a shorter version of what really happened, and it's in her own words, and it's in my voice, believe it or not, in hers. I never did that before. So I'm waiting to hear from the small publisher to get my contract, and I'm hoping that the book comes out for the memorial of my sister in July. That would be great. So it's called The Daughter's Promise.
That's great.
Yeah, and it teaches people what you have to know if you're going to become a caregiver for Alzheimer's, and there's like nothing I don't know. So this is truly a powerful novel, and the messages are clear. I just hope after everybody reads Marathon that more people will understand what's happening and force the tolerance and understanding, and be aware before you wrongly accuse someone, make sure that you're sure of what you're saying, and if you're not, keep quiet and don't say anything. So where can everybody find out more about you and your work?
They can find me all over the web. Obviously, they can they can, you know, find me at Amazon and bn.com and bookstores. My website is bfreemanbooks.com. That's all one word, bfreemanbooks.com. And they can find me on Twitter. They can find me on Facebook. The Facebook fan page is facebook.com/bfreemanfans. Again, one word, facebook.com/bfreemanfans. And I always encourage folks to send me emails, and you know, I really, with Marathon, I encourage book clubs to pick up this book and make it one of their titles. I think it's, again, it's a book designed to get people talking to each other, so I think it's perfect for book club discussions. And I've been telling people around the country, look, if you Marathon for your book club, shoot me an email and invite me to join your discussion. I would be happy to join by, you know, FaceTime or Skype or something like that. And I think that I would love to see a lot of book clubs around the country embrace Marathon.
And I know exactly who to send that to, because I have a cousin that joins a book club, and I'm going to email her afterwards and suggest it to her. She takes
Perfect.
My suggestions. They all do. They all do. But Bebo, there's Mother's Day coming up on Sunday, and then there's Father's Day in June, and nothing to me is better than a book. So why don't you just get one for everyone, and maybe we need to send some to some of the people in the United Nations so that they could read it, so that they understand.
Sure, I think so, too. I think so, too.
Seriously, so that they could understand, and maybe the president of Russia would like one, too, so he can understand that we're all here together to work together, not separate. And there's another one that's not too far away that's been in the news, too, that could use a little, you know, help. And thank you so very much for today. This, of course,
thank
is one
you,
of my
Fran.
Favorite interviews. And are you going to be at the PhilaFest by any chance on July?
Unfortunately, not this year. I'm going to be tied up on a tight Stride deadline, so I'll be home writing away on Stride and Serena and Maggie.
Oh, that's too bad, because I'm going to be there. They invited me again. I am really lucky that John Land invited me to come,
well, yeah.
And he's stuck with me. So I just enjoy it. I love the panels, and my husband loves going because he said it's like 3 days away from the job and everything. So thank you so much. By the way, Marcia was listening, and she's reading my comments on Facebook. And, yeah, everybody read my review. It's on Just Reviews. Everybody have a great day. It's beautiful outside. I am going to make the show public right now so that everybody can hear it and listen to it. And thank you so much, Brian. You this has been the best. Thank you
Good.
So
thank
much
you.
And everybody
My pleasure.
Have a great. Thank you. Everybody have a great day. Bye.